America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. For centuries, scientists and society cast moral judgments on anyone deemed mentally ill, confining many to asylums. Things are better now, we know that. But most recently, in the blockbuster interview that Meghan and Harry did with Oprah Winfrey, once again, that issue was put before us, front and center. So how far have we come? How much further do we need to go to understand what goes on in the body's most complex organ, the brain, and the stigma associated with it? We'll find out today on America Trends.
With me on America Trends is Roy Richard Grinker. He's written a book called Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness. And you are an anthropologist, and you also teach international affairs at George Washington University, yet you've got quite a background as it relates to issues related to psychiatry. Why don't you explain a little bit about your background?
Well, my background sort of helped set the stage for me to do research on mental health, because I was supposed to be a psychiatrist. You see, my great-grandfather was a psychiatrist, my grandfather was a psychiatrist, my father was a psychiatrist, and I'm married to a psychiatrist. And I was told even from a very young age that all roads would lead me to psychiatry. They didn't specify whether that was as a profession or whether I'd have to be in therapy. But I think that it ended up being a little of both. And though I didn't become a doctor, I did become a scholar who works on how mental health varies across cultures and what different cultures do about it.
I think it's a fascinating area, I've got to say it. And let me give you a couple of personal instances to start off our conversation. First of all, my mother, who was the gentlest soul in the world and died back in 1997, and so she was brought up in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and the like. And she had a saying that, everybody is nuts. And, by that she meant, you can never understand human behavior. She meant nothing by it. She didn't mean it to be pejorative in any way. And then I'll give you my own circumstance. I have a friend who definitely is obsessive compulsive and maybe even schizophrenic to some extent, though I certainly can't diagnose. But I had a really difficult time dealing with some of his behaviors, and it got to a point where I had to cut off the relationship simply because I really didn't know how to deal with it. And then I took a course in mental health first aid, and we can talk about that because I think a lot of people are aware of these programs. And I felt very badly at the way I ended our relationship, but he wasn't taking his medicine, and I know that it made many of his movements and his actions very difficult for me to understand. So I bring those two points up to say that I think a lot of us really want to understand better what we are really associating with and what we're dealing with and how well we're reacting to certain things that we see.
Well, Larry, I think that the point that you're making about your friend is perhaps similar to a point that many people might make about illnesses in general, whether it's cancers or other kinds of things. We don't necessarily know how to interact with and to help and support people who are suffering. And, if you go back to the early days when oncology was in its infancy and somebody who had cancer really didn't have a chance to survive. Many people abandoned those friends or loved ones. They didn't know how to engage with them. They didn't know what to do. If you think about the AIDS epidemic, in the beginning, you know, no one knew how it was transmitted. And so I think that mental illness is similar in some ways to all forms of suffering. And we need to be better prepared to support and help people who are suffering. And the more we know about it, the more awareness we have, the less frightened we'll be and the more ready we'll be to be there for them.
You say in the book that you were raised to believe that everyone had a little mental illness. And I agree with that. I mean, obviously, what I said about my friend was rather extreme. But I will say to you, Roy Richard Grinker, that I have my own eccentricities. I have my own neuroses. I think we all do. So on that spectrum, and you do such a great job in the book, perhaps even more detailed than I could absorb fully, to go through the various different forms of mental illness. And again, is it fair to say that nobody is normal?
I think it's totally fair to say that nobody is normal because we all change over time and we all exist on a kind of spectrum. The kind of thing that I guess it was your grandmother, she said everybody's a little nuts, or in the words of my family, everybody has some degree of mental illness, is another way of saying that we're human and that human beings are not static. We change, we suffer, we respond to suffering, sometimes better in some periods than in others. And we have our eccentricities that can sometimes become, you know, not just eccentricities, but they can impair our social life or our work life. One of the things that the neurodiversity advocates have been saying, and these are the folks, many of whom who are on the autism spectrum, have been saying, is that sometimes what we think of as illness also contains within it the seeds of what makes us interesting as people. I mean, imagine us all being some kind of quote-unquote normal. It would be a very, very boring world, and we probably wouldn't have a lot of creativity.
Oh, I can understand that fully. You say that stigma, and that's really what you're writing about in this book, isn't in our biology. It's in our culture. So American culture, which really relies on individualism, how much are we allowing people to be their true selves?
The book that I really set out to write, when I wrote Nobody's Normal, was to try not to focus only on American culture. But I think American culture is really interesting because we have emphasized so much that the ideal person is someone who is completely autonomous, you know, the master of their world, and they depend on no one. And so when we limit or discourage people from opening up about their suffering or being dependent on others, we do place constraints on them. You know, every society, whether it's the United States or anywhere else in the world, sets limits and restrictions on what kind of behavior we consider to be appropriate and inappropriate. Unfortunately, we tend to blame the person rather than the settings in which those people have difficulty. An example would be school. When we see a kid who's not learning well, we might think, oh, well, something's wrong with them. They have attention deficit issues or they have autism. And we don't think first about whether the educational setting is something that could be changed to better accommodate that student.
You say that perhaps some psychiatric conditions can be looked upon more like the common cold, and certain mental issues are dealt with much more appropriately, I think, if we look at it, where we really do say, oh, I understand that. I have sympathy for that. I can understand why that person is going through this. And you spend a lot of time talking about those who have gone to war and the whole issue of PTSD. Why don't you help us understand that as a part of a looking glass into the range of issues or conditions that we're really talking about here?
in the years and decades leading up to World War I, most people thought about the mental health professions like psychiatry or neurology as being for people who were very, very seriously ill, you know, so seriously ill they couldn't function at all in society, and they were often relegated to asylums or prisons. Mm-hmm. And the thing that happened in wars, particularly the world wars, is that we realized that even really otherwise quote-unquote, you know, typical or normal people under the right conditions can really experience a lot of emotional distress. And so the great advantage or the great benefit that we see in the growth of psychiatry over the 20th century is the expansion of the mental health professions from the most seriously ill to those who would suffer in silence or in shame. And I think that there's a feedback, though. You know, the more we understand that mental illnesses are more common and they can exist on a spectrum, the more we can also understand and sympathize with the very seriously mentally ill.
What does this tell us about brain science? You say in the book that the brain is much more complicated than the heart or the pancreas or any of the other organs. How much do we really have to understand that these are situations related to the brain, and we, even in the field of psychiatry, need to understand a lot more? And I'd love to get your impression, surrounded as you are in your life by psychiatrists, where that profession is and the legitimacy that it has. There are a lot of people who discount it, saying, well, you're just giving us medicine. And you tell us in the book that we haven't made a lot of medicinal advances in the recent period.
I think that the effort to define mental illnesses biologically has not delivered. And I don't think that that's because psychiatrists failed or neuroscientists did bad science, but it's for two reasons. First, that the brain is so much more complex than any other organ. And secondly, it's that when we think about mental illnesses, we have to consider so many, many factors that are involved. Genetics, poverty, the society in which one lives that allows one to get treatment or encourages somebody not to get treatment. We have to consider all the social factors that impinge upon and shape the experience of a mental illness. And frankly, it's the same with biological conditions too. We know that people who have serious, serious physical illnesses, like cancers, do better when they have better emotional and social supports, when they have health insurance, when they have access to good care. And it shouldn't be any different for mental illnesses, except that we tend to be less comfortable thinking about mental illnesses as the product of a multitude of factors that are acting in concert. And we want to reduce it and say, okay, well, maybe I can give this medicine, or maybe I can find this gene or this neurochemical imbalance. But I don't think that the human experience is ever going to be able to be reduced to biological mechanisms and materials.
Are we trying to do that now as we're looking to figure out what's happening with this growth in our understanding to some extent, but our inability to deal with Alzheimer's, for example? Is that a leading edge of research that is going on now?
Well, we certainly have had the decade of the brain, and we've had all kinds of initiatives to try and think about mental illnesses in the words of the very well-respected psychiatrist Nancy Andreasen as a broken brain. But I think we have to take a lesson from medicine, not just psychiatry, but medicine in general, to just see how important it is to consider the kind of society in which we live. You know, imagine somebody has breast cancer. A woman is diagnosed with breast cancer. Well, we can use chemotherapy to treat it. You can look at the tumor under a microscope, And you think, well, that cancer, that's got a physical reality that we don't yet have for a mental illness. You know, you can't look under a microscope and see a mental illness. But in reality, that person who has cancer, their treatment, their experience, their social relationships, their finances, all of that stuff is going to be affected by their illness. And what psychiatry needs to focus on is how much it can offer to the understanding and treatment of human suffering in context, in a particular kind of social setting. None of that stuff that happens, that experience that a woman has who has breast cancer is visible under a microscope. None of it. Why should we expect that mental illnesses have to be visible under a microscope? We need to not try and emulate medicine. We need to think about changing psychiatry so that it is not so focused on this illusion of reducing mental illnesses to biology.
You tell us that nearly 20% of all American adults, more than 60 million people, meet the criteria of having some form of mental illness. What is the right term, by the way, today? How would you best typify it?
So that's an interesting question. How do we talk about prevalence and how do we talk about whether somebody has a mental illness? When we talk about a mental illness, we're talking about a framework that has been developed by consensus, by mental health professionals, and they put these disorders and describe them in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. So if we say that somebody has a mental illness or a diagnosis, what we mean is that they meet the criteria as defined by consensus by a group of clinicians. But those criteria change over time. And so what counts as depression today isn't the same thing that counted as depression 100 years ago. Post-traumatic stress disorder, for example, is a pretty much brand new diagnosis. It's about 50 years old, right? That's not very long. Now, that's not to say that people in the Civil War, or the Revolutionary War, didn't experience incredible, lasting, enduring emotional distress from wars, but we didn't have a framework for it. And so that's why in the book I talk about Nepal and how mental health professionals told people who came in to do global health work, oh, we don't have post-traumatic stress disorder here. Well, they didn't mean people weren't suffering from the effects of war, earthquakes, poverty, and so on. What they meant is that they didn't conceive of a mental illness in that way. And so one of the important points that I try to emphasize in Nobody's Normal is not just that our definitions of mental illness change over time, but the way we experience them changes. 100 years ago, we experienced emotional distress more through things like diarrhea and headaches and fatigue and temporary blindness and deafness and mutism and very physical ailments. And today, we're more likely to express our emotional distress by talking about feeling sad or anxious. And each of these sets of symptoms are different endpoints, and how we define and think about our suffering is determined by the historical period in which we live.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Roy Richard Grinker, Nobody's Normal. Our society made psychiatric conditions, you tell us, frightening and shameful. A double illness. First, you've got the situation that you're dealing with in the brain. And second, you have society's negative judgments about it. And they are reinforcing and often isolating, I would imagine. In the situation that I mentioned to you, I had a really hard time, as I said. And I'm just wondering how we as a society are moving forward as these definitions of these conditions are changing. Are we really changing? Because I know there's a big debate, there has been, about insurance coverage for those conditions of the brain as opposed to other conditions of the rest of the body. Are we finding parity and some equilibrium as it relates to understanding that this too is a huge issue that the society needs to address?
I think we're getting better at parity. Insurance companies are occasionally now reimbursing better than they did before. But when I say that, I mean reimbursing for people who are going to mental health professionals. The majority of people who have mental health problems still seek help for those problems through their primary care physicians. And so we need to better understand the disparity in treatment access, that when somebody experiences emotional distress, they may experience it through fatigue or a headache or stomach ailments. They may think that they have a purely physical illness and might see a primary care physician. And not only do the majority of people with a mental health problem see a primary care physician for it, but the primary care physician often becomes the major provider of mental health care. And what we're now seeing that I think is just incredibly positive is we're seeing a lot more medical students get interested in psychiatry. We're seeing a lot more competition in residency applications. It used to be, even 20 years ago, that it was hard for residencies in psychiatry in the U.S. to fill their spots, and they had to go out of the country to get, you know, qualified foreign students. And now it's so selective, and it's so hard to get in because psychiatry is becoming more popular. It's becoming more popular because we're becoming more open about how common mental illnesses are, and also about how they can be treated, and treated in such a way that people can worry about the illness more than what will people think about the illness. That's it was in your question, you know, where you said, what did you mean by that, a double illness? The problem of the double illness is that people worry more about the society's reaction, their moral judgment, than about the illness itself.
But our society, when you look at it, we used to institutionalize people. We used to use different methods of dealing with these situations. And then we went into more community-based activity, which you point out in 1963. JFK, the last law that he signed before his assassination, was this deinstitutionalization. He, of course, had a sister in his family who was dealing with these issues. So the question really is, have we really deinstitutionalized in a proper way? Because I have a friend who runs a facility here in a city adjacent to where I live, and he's telling me that a lot of what we see in our prisons is really not criminal behavior, but behavior of someone who has a mental illness.
In fact, prisons are the largest provider of mental health care today. But the goal of deinstitutionalization was that there were people who were warehoused, essentially almost, you know, exiled from society, banished to institutions. Some were okay, some institutions, but probably, you know, the majority were pretty bad, and people sort of rotted there with very little specialized health care. Many of these institutions in the United States were deplorable places. And so the worthy goal of deinstitutionalization was to return people to their families, to the community, so they could get care there. Unfortunately, we didn't provide the proper funding, and we didn't provide the proper supports, and the stigma of mental illness was still too profound. And so, yeah, deinstitutionalization was a worthy goal, but people ended up kind of dumped into their neighborhoods, and a lot of them ended up on the street experiencing homelessness, and many people ended up in prisons. And I think that's one of the biggest mental health crises today, is to go back and see how can we really sort of reinvent this notion of a community-based psychiatry so that people aren't, you know, made to spend the rest of their lives in jail.
You pointed to a scholar in your work who suggested that maybe we should even think about going back to better run facilities for people as opposed to a community approach. Where are we headed as a society when we talk about adults? Because I do want to talk about children in a moment, but where are we headed as you see it?
Well, I think that asking any question about where we're headed with mental health is a really tough one because the range of different kinds of conditions is so wide, because the severity is so variable. But there are some really encouraging signs, and I see it in my classroom because I'm a professor and I teach people who are between the ages of, say, 18 and 25 years old. Most of them are freshmen and sophomores. And they come in to class and they will come right up to me and say something like, well, just give you one example, Professor Grinker, I have autism. I do crossword puzzles during your lectures. It helps me to focus on your lecture. I want you to know so that I am not taken to be someone who's not paying attention. Or the student who says, I have attention deficit disorder. I need extra time on exams. And I hear these people say these things to me from day one of class, and I say, wow, what happened? Who taught these people? Who helped these people advocate for themselves, take ownership of their particular challenges, and to advocate for themselves? Something really good is happening that people can do this. And I got the title of the book, Nobody's Normal, from one of these young students who asked me, after I was reeling off all the statistics about the prevalence of mental illnesses, isn't anyone normal anymore? And I was like, well, no. Nobody's ever been normal. Normal has just been a concept that we used to try and make people conform to whatever the ideal is at a particular historical moment.
But I do want to ask you, somebody listening to this, who says, I'm down in the dumps from time to time, particularly during the pandemic. And if you want to give any reference to what we are going through and the social isolation and the impacts of that on our mental health and our behaviors within the home, please do address that. But help us understand, what's the difference if I say, gee, about every 3 or 4 days, you know, I really feel good about things, and then I feel real lousy about things, and then I snap out of it. Or I don't for a couple of days, and they're wondering whether they have just a case of, again, the blues, to call it something, or I really am in some kind of depressive state that is ongoing, and maybe I should see someone, because you also point out in the book that many people don't ever go see anyone.
So the definition of mental illness is something that you should, you know, you'd ask a clinician. I'm not a clinician. I'm an anthropologist who's observing trends in American society as they relate to mental health. But what I can say is that, as with any kind of condition, there is a point at which it becomes a significant impairment. You know, we don't always go get treatment for, a joint or a bone that hurts. But if it prevents us from walking, if it prevents us from sleeping, if it prevents us from doing our daily activities, like walking to the store or work, well, yeah, then we better get treatment. And it's the same with mental illness, that one meets the criteria for a mental illness when there's enough severity that it's really affecting your life in a very negative way, that it's impairing your functioning. Because all of us get sad. All of us get anxious. We all exist on this spectrum somewhere, but we can move along that spectrum. And I think that this notion of the spectrum is important, but we have to understand that there becomes a point when you deserve to get treatment and you deserve to get care. And I think that the thing about the COVID pandemic that is very interesting to me is that the periods of time during which mental illnesses became less stigmatized and people sought more care were the times when there was a sort of universal stressor. World War I, World War II, Korean War. These were times when there was this, everybody was under stress. And to experience emotional distress was not considered that abnormal. In fact, it was sort of expected. Who could be not stressed out by living, you know, at a time when so many of your relatives were overseas dying? And what has happened now is that we have this universal stressor that has come upon us of this virus. And it is creating a kind of understanding that we're all suffering. Everybody is suffering. And so for somebody to seek mental health care during a pandemic whether it's from social isolation or economic hardship or even the other things that are going on, like racial tensions and political tensions. These things are now sort of expected.
Absolutely. I did a podcast on how our political differences are bringing a lot of people to a place where they feel very, very uncomfortable with their own feelings about what is happening. Let me lace a couple of things together. You say people often sense that a physical disease can be dealt with, but a mental illness goes on forever. And we have a lot of young people who are, as you say, expressing themselves, saying, I have autism. And I think it's fair to say we didn't know anything about autism several years back, so you can help us with that. ADHD, some people say, isn't that overdiagnosed just for an active boy, at their very young age? And then, of course, at the very end of this process, the most debilitating and the most distressing is we see a rise in suicides among our teenagers. Can you kind of lace all of that together for us?
There are some of my students who sort of sense that there's more mental illness now than ever before, that there's this like an epidemic of mental illnesses. But one of the things that I've argued in Nobody's Normal, and I argued it too in a previous book on autism called Unstrange Minds, is that the more treatment and the more diagnosis we have in a society, the more we'll use a particular framework. Like if we start to think that autism is something that we can treat, that we have some interventions for it, and that that word drives certain useful special education programs, we'll give that diagnosis more and more. Eating disorders, attention deficit disorder, these were diagnoses that became popular because they conferred a benefit of getting people some kind of care. And a diagnosis is only as good as the benefit it provides. So let me give you an example. We used to have this diagnosis of Asperger's disorder.
Mm.
And today it's been eliminated by consensus by the American Psychiatric Association that says, no, we're just going to get rid of Asperger's disorder and we're just going to use autism. Why? Because they said they couldn't reliably diagnose or make a diagnostic differentiation between autism and Asperger's disorder. So better to just subsume it under autism. But they knew that when they invented the term Asperger's disorder in the 1990s. So why did we have this other term? Not because it was an illness that didn't exist before and now exists, but because we needed a term at that time that was less stigmatizing than the word autism, that suggested that somebody could be educated and could be verbal and could be highly intelligent and capable of an education and getting into the workforce. But today, autism is so much less stigmatized as a word because we've come to think of it as such a wide spectrum. We don't need Asperger's anymore. Asperger's did its job, and now we don't need it. It's not that there was this sickness that once existed and now it's gone. It was that there was a framework that was really useful for us, and we've progressed to a point where we don't need it anymore.
What about the suicide increases that we see in our society among teenagers? What does that tell us? What kind of warning signal is that about the interventions that are necessary much sooner?
Well, on the question of suicide, you know, there are so many experts who study depression and suicidality and they really are, you know, compassionate researchers who know their stuff. But if there's one thing that I can observe from looking at their work, it is that the percentage of people who do attempt and complete a suicide that never got mental health care is way too high. That mental health care is something that needs to be given early rather than when it is too late. Let me give you an example with schizophrenia. When people have their first psychosis with schizophrenia, the average time between first psychosis and first visit to a mental health professional is 74 weeks. Mm. 74 weeks. Now, can you imagine waiting that long if you'd had a heart attack to see a doctor, or a broken leg to see a doctor, or a fever to see a doctor? But 74 weeks. And so we really need to pay attention to earlier interventions, particularly because most mental illnesses are developmental, meaning that they have their onset in adolescence and early adulthood. And so we can see the seeds of it before it gets too complicated and, you know, too involved at younger ages. But again, I am not a clinician. I want to stress that. I'm not a clinician. I'm a social scientist who's observing trends.
What about the trend that other medical conditions do not define someone's personhood, and yet still the stigma, and of course the subtitle of your book is How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness, so that means culture can wipe it away, but you say that it too often comes to represent a person as a whole. I mean, we don't say, oh, you're a cancer. We say, oh, that person has cancer, but we may describe somebody as being depressive or schizophrenic, but that's not their whole life being.
Yes, so of course there have been points in time where physical illnesses did define people, like leprosy, where Europeans referred to people as lepers. But in general, the tendency to see a mental illness as defining one's identity is linked up with the idea that a mental illness is something that you have or you don't have. It's either or. Not that you can exist on this spectrum and change over time, right? And so the part of stigma is that it's a brand, it's a label, the word stigma actually comes from the ancient Greek meaning of branding on the flesh, like a permanent, you know, permanent mark, you know, as if once labeled, you know, you are always that. And we still see, you know, aspects of that with alcoholism, substance abuse, and so on. But getting, you know, these brands, that's so stigmatizing because, and so much of an object of fear for people as they try to get mental health care. So one of the interesting things that I write about in Nobody's Normal is a group of people that I spent time with in Namibia in southern Africa. And there, if somebody has symptoms of a particular illness, well, they would say they have that illness. But if somebody doesn't have those symptoms, perhaps because a medication has helped alleviate the symptoms, they're not considered to have that sickness at all. So I talk about a man named Tomzo, and he goes to a clinic that's about 20 kilometers or 12 miles or so from his village once a month to get antipsychotic medications. And everybody there at that clinic has him down as schizophrenic. He is a person who is a schizophrenic, like this permanent label. But the medicines are actually working really well right now for the time being. And so he doesn't have any label at home in his village because he's not experiencing the symptoms. So in one community, the clinic, which is run by a Scandinavian non-governmental organization, he's got this permanent label. But in his community, he's not stigmatized with this label because the medicines are alleviating his psychotic symptoms.
What are the tools that we have available to us? I mentioned earlier with psychiatry that we often look at it as a medicinal anti-psychotic drug or whatever that might be prescribed. What are the tools in the toolbox today? Because I think you talk about certain therapies that people might have thought are out of bounds today, but they may not be in certain situations.
Sometimes the stigma of mental illnesses is profound enough that it can actually pose a challenge to treatment. There are many people that I interviewed for this book who said they didn't want to take psychiatric medications because they thought that somehow they would be permanent. They'd have to be on them forever. But these are some of the same people who are taking statins to lower their blood pressure, and they expect to take those forever, or who have a thyroid problem and are taking a thyroid hormone, and they expect to take that forever. There are other people who are so severely depressed, and they haven't responded to any medicine at all, in any treatment, but resist electroconvulsive therapy, because there's this sort of lasting image in our minds, whether it's from Hollywood films or whatever it might be, that this, that the jolt of electricity, this tiny jolt of electricity to the brain is somehow torture, which is very different, of course, from the jolt of electricity that's the hero of so many medical dramas in which somebody's given a jolt of electricity to their heart and it saves their life, right? But when you have a life-saving therapy like electroconvulsive therapy for people who've been resistant to any other treatment, there's this negative reaction because the brain is different from the heart, from the liver, from any other organ. It's like the seat of the soul. And so that's, you know, I'm not a clinician that can tell you that electroconvulsive therapy works or doesn't work, but what I can tell you is that there is resistance to electroconvulsive therapy, not because of any reality of it being torture or brutality, but because of stigma and because of the meanings, the symbolic meanings that we give to the brain.
There are so many topics that we could continue to talk about, but I really want people to understand just how layered and textured this issue is and how well you deal with it in the book. And I think you've expressed yourself so well. Let me just ask you in closing, when we think about all these ways that society reflects back on these conditions and thus what we give as a sense of permanence to the individual, unfortunately, and we are changing as you suggest, but what about the workplace? I mean, somebody who actually wants to seek out help. There are many workplaces that offer various assistance programs. I know when I worked in a 9-to-5 situation, we had a relationship with a clinic. So tell us whether we're breaking that barrier down, because I'm wondering where law and regulation and protections against discrimination for the stigmas that this society has placed on various conditions of the brain, where are we in that regard?
And it's interesting that many of the accommodations that disability rights advocates have been arguing for, like remote work, like more flexible hours, that those sorts of accommodations sort of overnight became normalized after the pandemic started. That the pandemic did sort of overnight what, you know, people hadn't been able to really get through for years and years. I think that we are appreciating in the workplace that mental health is a real barrier, not just to people's health, but also to their dignity and also to even the bottom line of whether your business does well, because more days are lost from labor because of mental health issues than almost anything else. I heard a wonderful story from a security company called CSX in Australia, where they had put in an autism program where they would provide accommodations to people with autism. Mm-hmm. And then after that happened, other people who didn't have autism, but maybe they had something else going on, anxiety disorder or PTSD, or in one case, a woman who was not feeling herself because she was going through menopause, felt more comfortable going to their bosses and saying, I have this issue. And so the remarkable thing about this autism hiring program was how it generalized to other sorts of things. And I remember in this conversation I had with this executive, he said of the woman who came to him and said, you know, I'm just not feeling myself these days. I hope my work isn't suffering. I have issues related to menopause. He said, what a remarkable thing. How is this happening at this time? That a woman is coming to me about a female, specifically female issue, identifying herself as an aging female at that, for something that used to be so hush-hush and stigmatized. What an amazing advance that is. And where did it come from? It came from an autism program. So whenever we look at any particular area in mental health where we're making progress, it's the tide that seems to be raising all boats.
Very interesting. By the way, you have some wonderful articles that are posted by way of Psychology Today. When the body speaks, will people with COVID-19 get the mental health care they need? And I'm just wondering, you have many others. What is a happy life when VIPs have a mental illness? Are we going to see people getting, because the services are not enough for many people who have been deinstitutionalized, let alone those people who, as a result of what you call this overarching issue that has surrounded and enveloped all of us, recognizing that it's impacting their own mental health, are we going to be able to provide those services?
I hope that we will be able to provide better mental health services. But one of the things I'm trying to do in some of those Psychology Today blogs is to draw attention to the resistance to see physical symptoms as having a psychiatric component. My grandfather was a very strong advocate for providing mental health care to people who had cancer and liver disease and other kinds of really serious illnesses that they were having trouble coping with emotionally. Nobody ever accused him of saying that because they should get mental health care that their cancer was like in their head, right? Or that their liver disease was made up. But with some, when there are some medical conditions that are mysterious and we don't yet quite understand them, and somebody recommends mental health care, the reaction can often be one of, are you saying it's in my head? Are you saying I'm making it up? Instead of understanding that everything in the world is, in the human world, is associated with our brains. Everything. Let me tell you a remarkable thing. There's all this epigenetic research that is about gene regulation. And we're taught in biology that Lamarck was wrong about evolution. You can't acquire characteristics during your life and then pass them on genetically to your offspring. You can't, you know, if I have a leg that's amputated, my child won't be born with one leg, right? Can't pass that on. But we're now discovering that when people experience incredible emotional hardship in their lives, there are alterations to our gene regulation that can be passed on to the subsequent generations. In other words, Lamarck wasn't entirely wrong. So if somebody whose parent endured horrible hardships, like living through a genocide, and they experience certain mental health issues that might be associated with their parents' experience, do we say that's biological? Yes. Do we say it's psychiatric? Yes. In that sense, in that example, it makes no sense to even try to make a separation between the body and the mind, right? Because it's both of those. And so when somebody has a physical ailment that is partially psychiatric or for which psychiatry can help, it's not saying that that condition isn't real. It's saying that that condition can be benefited from a much broader range of interventions than we thought.
Well, fascinating conversation. I really encourage people to get this book, Nobody's Normal, How Culture Created the Stigma of Mental Illness, Roy Richard Grinker. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Well, thank you so much for having me.